Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this Earth Day is Eric Sanderson, a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN, Want Green Cities? Lose the Cars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Sanderson.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Although I must say Paul Ehrlich has depressed me somewhat.
Yeah.
He gives us a 10% chance of getting it right before it's too late. What's your odds?
Well, I don't think we should be, you know, foreguessing what's going to happen in the future and casting aspersions on our possibility to make a better world out of it. You know, I think we should kind of bring that kind of can-do attitude that America had, say, during World War II, as Dr. Ehrlich said, and bring that to the problems that face us. And I think it's pretty clear what we need to do. What's hard is finding the political will to do it.
Well, presumably the political will come, I think, from below. It won't come from the top, will it? I mean, there's too much of a vested interest in business as usual, isn't there?
That's right. I think that's how democracy is supposed to work, right? So
right.
I think that's why you know, I wrote this little piece for CNN.com, and I can't believe the traffic and all the comments about it. It's you know, it was meant to be provocative to suggest that if you want a green city, then you should not drive your car. And I didn't emphasize the environmental aspects of driving so much as the social aspects, you know, the expense that's associated with driving, the noise, the lack of parking, the traffic, and all the kind of social and economic costs that come with that. And then just suggested some ways that we can try and maybe move beyond, not everywhere, but in at least in our denser cities, to a life that's not so dependent on the car. And that's going to help us with oil and some of the things that Dr. Ehrlich was going to talk about, and it's going to help us with pollution. And it's going to help us make better cities that are more productive and better places to live.
Well, before we get into the choices or between cities versus suburbs or finding ways to around this suburban infrastructure that we have, just to touch on what you just talked about, which has generated a lot of traffic, and it certainly has gotten my interest in your article at CNN, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. You say, want to give yourself a 17% raise? Stop driving. The average American spends more money on transportation than food each year. They spend twice as much money on transportation as on health care.
I mean, yeah, isn't that amazing? That's government statistics. That's last year's figures from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Washington.
But then let's add to that then the damage we get from the absurdity of gridlock. In 1982, the average American spent 16 hours each year stalled in traffic. In 2011, traffic contributed to an average of 38 hours of misery per year, costing the nation an estimated $120 billion in lost time and wasted fuel. And another study shows that on an average, 30% of the traffic in cities is the result of people just cruising to find parking. I must say, I've found myself doing that and cursing under my breath.
Yeah, well, this is the American condition, right? This is what it means to live in America in 2014, particularly if you live in one of our cities and depend on your car to get to work.
Well, that's the whole point, though, isn't it? That statistics show that a car on a street can move about 4,400 people an hour, but the same street could move 52,000 people by bus, streetcar, or subway at the same time, saving enormous amounts of energies and cutting down on pollution.
Yeah, that's right. And also being quieter and more efficient. And if, you know, more people were spending some of the money they currently pour into their cars on public transportation, then it would also become more affordable. Of course, the thing that, you know, I couldn't write in 700 words is that it also depends on the form of the city, and we've, you know, put at least 100 years into building cities that depend on the car and depend on it to get around. So this is, you know, the kind of solutions I talk about in the piece are mostly about our denser cities to start with. But I think even for some of our suburbs, if we can increase the density 2 or 3 times over where they are, your average suburb is about 1,000 to 4,000 people per square mile. And if those cities were about 10,000 people per square mile, then public transportation starts to pay for itself, And you get start to get some of these other benefits that come with denser cities.
So you have to re-engineer then a way of life, don't you? You'd have to concentrate people in smaller areas to say.
Well, I mean, the amazing thing is you know, people are a lot of people, particularly young people, are selecting that lifestyle.
Right.
You know, just the costs of having a car are so big, and if you add that on top of college debts and other debts young people have, and the struggles they're having, and finding a job in the economy, it starts to make sense for them to move back to cities. In the same way that, you know, urbanization is the number one land use trend of the last 100 years. You know, people are moving in huge percentages to cities, and even, you know, in developing countries, they're often living in very poor circumstances, but they do it because that's the best opportunity for themselves and for their kids to have a better life.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Sanderson, a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN.com, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. So, but the idea, I guess, is that if more people concentrated in cities or suburbs shrunk, and then you would be able to have what greater lands for commons. In other words, the idea that we have to travel all these distances to go to work is counterintuitive.
That's right. That's right. You know, I think, you know, we have a history in the United States anyway of cheap oil for a very long time, for our grandparents' generation and for our parents' generation. But of course, that circumstance doesn't really hold anymore. And because oil was so cheap through most of the 20th century and controlled in a way so that it was so cheap, that encouraged people to drive their cars because that made the most sense. They were the fastest way to get around, and they were also very cheap. And so people, you know, bought cars in legions, and that helped the economy. And then they, you know, used those cars to drive to new houses on the edge of town where they would take a farm field and develop it and build a suburban housing block. And then next year they would do the next one out and the next one out and the next one out. And then I think, for me, I think it's, you know, sometime in the late 70s, 80s, we basically ran out of the edge. We got to the edge of what I call in the book the practical commuting horizon, where it doesn't really make sense to build the next ring of houses out because you have to commute so far to get back into the city. And but our economy was so geared to this lifestyle of cheap oil and cheap cars and cheap land on the edge of the city that it kept going and going and going. And I think there's pretty strong evidence in my mind that eventually led to things like the financial collapse in 2008 when, you know, housing prices collapsed. And of course, the places where the houses were foreclosed and people lost their houses were in those outer rings of the suburbs where people are making, you know, hour-long commutes to get to work. Which is, of course, doubly sad because those are, you know, mostly young families who are just trying to do the best they can in a system, an overall economic system that is sort of just run out of any more potential. And so I think, you know, the way we think about the new economy of the 21st century is that we, you know, price our natural resources and price pollution accordingly, using various kind of forms of tax shifting schemes, in such a way that it helps us make our cities better, in such a way that it helps make our transportation systems better, in such a way that helps us have that kind of renewable energy generation that everybody, even the oil companies, know we're going to eventually.
So, Eric Sanderson, your book, Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs, shows how the American relationship to nature shaped our past and predicates our future. So, are we talking, and of course, we're thinking about the pioneers, the buffalo, all of that, and yeah, going back further to the Native Americans who lived in perfect harmony with their environment. Is this to say then that we have got to sort of rediscover nature and a way to exist with nature?
I think what we need to do is value nature and not just value it in a spiritual way and an ethical way, although those are very important, but also in a real way, in an economic way. And, you know, there's a set of tax schemes, Pigouvian taxes or externality taxes or severance taxes, double dividends are sometimes called too, which are ways of taxing natural resources in a way that those costs then get transmitted through the rest of the economy. And it's the kind of idea that actually has a huge amount of support in the technical community. Economists, both on the right and the left, think it's a good idea. Environmental scientists think it's a good idea. These sort of ecological economists think that, you know, having taxes that, that reflect the true value of natural resources, not just the extraction value, but the value that they are to nature, is the way to reform our economy and actually create not just green cities, but green countries and a green world. That will address the kinds of things that Dr. Ehrlich was talking to you about before.
Well, your book does talk about a self-reinforcing cycle of tax reform, retrofitted towns and cities, bicycles and streetcars, and investments in renewable energy. Just paint us a picture then of what a new city would be like with biking, walking, and light rail, doing away with the need for cars.
Yeah, well, the first thing is it would be a lot quieter. You'd probably live closer to where you worked, and your employer would help you do that. So you would be able to walk to work or bike to work, or, you know, if the weather's bad or if you're, you know, not feeling well or you're elderly, there'd be a streetcar or a light rail, something like that, that's moving across, you know, over the surface of the ground to take you to work. The idea is that maybe we can move our stuff underground or move it at night so that the freight in and out of the city could use the same system, but at night when it's being less used. And you'd have all this additional space to do good things in the city with. You know, right now about 50 to 60% of our cities are devoted to the transportation space in our cities. So that's the most valuable real estate in the country. And if we could free up a fraction of that by being more efficient with it, then that would allow our economies to do better, allow our social lives to do better. And then it means that maybe we can even reclaim some of that land that's on the edge of the city and turn that back to agriculture, turn that back to wild places so that you could, you know, have a great job, have all the cultural amenities of the city, and also be able to know the people that grow your food or even be the person who grows your food. I think, you know, as a technical matter, as a sort of matter of physics and biology, we can figure this out. The really hard thing is figuring out the politics. And like you say, I think that has to start with your listeners and with the people out there, the people I'm trying to reach out to through CNN and with my book.
And what about reinventing work? I mean, already you have people, doing telecommuting, if you will, working at home. I mean, most people work in computers in big offices at any rate, so it makes you wonder why they can't do the same work at home.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think telecommuting has a lot of potential, but I also think it's important for people to interact with each other. I work in a global conservation program. I work for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and I have colleagues all over the world, and we mostly communicate through the computer. But it still is a great joy when I get to see them and talk to them in person. So I think there's always going to be a need to be able to meet face-to-face, and there's a lot of value that comes from that. But, you know, I think it all depends on being able to live a little bit closer to where you work so that these other forms of transportation become possible and even more desirable.
Sure. Well, you know, I don't know whether you saw that Larry David show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, here in L.A., you know, you have a fast lane on the freeway, but you have to have more than one person.
Yeah.
And he hired a hooker, you know. Just, but the point is that if you drive on the freeways in L.A., you just look at all these cars that are just jammed in gridlock, and a handful of cars go whizzing by in the fast lane. There are so few people that, and the idea, if you have one other person with you, at least you're interacting with humanity. You're not just a slave to this damn automobile, you know?
Yeah, no, that's right. I think it's so much, what you grew up with. I grew up in California, too. I grew up in the Bay Area and grew up in the suburbs and thought that you just drove your car because that's what everybody did. And it wasn't actually until I moved to New York and realized that there was another way of living, and that it was actually a pretty good way of living, I was still American, and I still held the same values. I still like baseball and apple pie and all those things. And we still have, I should say, you know, my family, we still have a car because where we live, it's still sort of necessary. We're still sort of trapped in the same system. But at least I can glimpse the possibilities of a better public transportation system and a bicycle infrastructure and a life that isn't all about the commute, but is actually about living my life.
Well, Eric Sanderson, I thank you so much for joining us here on Earth Day.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Sanderson, as a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN.com, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time was